This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
And today in our 425th episode, we have a bunch of news, including I think you have a new titanosaur.
Sure do.
And I've got an update on medullary bone, potentially some more of that.
There's also some gut contents in a microraptor.
You also have a dinosaur connection challenge, don't you?
Oh, yes. Princess seams. How might we connect dinosaurs to princess seams? You'll just have to listen and find out.
Yeah, which is, I guess it relates to dinosaurs wearing clothing, which sounds very fun.
Well, that's one take.
Oh, you got multiple takes. And I've got a fun fact, which comes from our bonus content. Sabrina accidentally challenged me to finding out about state dinosaur fossils. So I'm going to do that.
You just find challenges everywhere.
I do. And we have dinosaur of the day, Isanosaurus. But before we get into all of that, we have some new patrons to thank. And this is the first episode we're recording in 2023. So we're thanking all of the people that joined basically from the end of December through the beginning of January, very beginning of January. We have five new patrons to thank.
Awesome.
Yes, it is so great. There is Paul B. who joined. There's also Sam, and we've got Dong, Bryman, and Malleus.
Hey, thanks so much for being a dino-it-all, joining our community.
Yes, and like we were saying, make sure you get those addresses updated if you're at the Triceratops level and up, so we can send you that special limited edition patch. And then rounding out our shout-outs, we've got Tarkia Tamer, Seamus B., Luke, Ewan, and Eric.
Yes, thank you so much for being a part of our community and listening to our show and supporting us for the past 8 years.
Yes.
Jumping into the news, I've got the new dinosaur, so I get to start it off. As Garrett mentioned, there's a new Titanosaur in town. Well, in town in Brazil.
If you're in Brazil, it's in town. Yeah. If you're in the right town in Brazil, I guess. And it's probably not a town with a lot of people in it.
I'm not sure. But this Titanosaur is named Caeira alocadata, and was found in the Serra da Galga formation. The authors compared the bones to other dinosaurs that had been found in the same area, because this area is rich in titanosaurs, turns out. There's Baru Titan and Trigonosaurus, and they also compared it to Uberabatitan. And this paper, not only did they name a new titanosaur, they also did some lumping. So they found that Trigonosaurus pricei, that's the full name, is a junior synonym of Baru Titan brittoi. And they did this because they were describing some new specimens, new in that they hadn't been described before. They'd been found a long time ago in the 1950s.
But not described before.
Yes, and the specimens that they described, they found, were also Baru Titan.
Oh, I see. So it filled in the gaps. Whatever things looked unique about Trigonosaurus actually happened to be in Baru Titan, but we couldn't tell until we found these, or described.
Exactly.
These new bones that sort of merged that gap.
It's like Baru Titan and Trigonosaurus had fossils that didn't overlap, so we couldn't tell for sure that if they were the same or different. And then with these new specimens, they found, okay, these new ones are Baru Titan, and we can see now some overlapping features. So that's why Trigonosaurus is a junior synonym. But not only that, they found that one of the, what was thought to be a specimen of Trigonosaurus, part of that specimen, specifically the tail part, is what they named the new dinosaur. So that was different.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, you see that sometimes, rather than just saying like, well, this tail part is the previous named thing, And we're going to take the rest of it out and put it into the other previously named thing. They come up with a new name because otherwise it's too confusing, because you could go back to that original description of that old name and it's got a bunch of stuff in it that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. So it's easier just to make a new name sometimes.
Exactly. Now, this titanosaur, Kyura, probably looked like other titanosaurs, but again, we're going off the tail vertebrae here. It would have been large, had a long tail, walked on four legs, and had a long neck. As I said, there's a lot of titanosaurs that have been found in this area. There was field work done in the 1940s and 60s by Llewellyn Ivor Price, who found a lot of the fossils. And the holotype of what's now Kyura was found in 1957. According to the paper, which was published in Peer J by Julian C.G. Silva Jr. and others, quote, Price was responsible for unearthing a remarkable set of titanosaur remains from the quarry known as Kyura. So that's how we got the name. This included three specimens known as Series A, B, and C. Now, Series A, there was a lot of neck and trunk vertebrae, and it was partially described, but it wasn't assigned to any particular dinosaur. Series B, quote, is one of the best preserved titanosaurs recorded in the area, end quote. Yeah, it includes the neck and trunk vertebrae, parts of the pelvis, and that eventually became the paratype for Trigonosaurus pricei. And Series C includes tail vertebrae and chevrons, and eventually that one was named Barutitan brittoi. Then more field work was done in the 1980s and 1990s, and they found even more titanosaur bones. So the authors described all these specimens. These are the new specimens, and that led to them naming Kyura and lumping together Barutitan and Trigonosaurus. Well, going back to, they did also compare to that other dinosaur, Uberabatitan, and they found that these dinosaurs were different from Uberabatitan, but there was only minor differences compared to the holotypes of Trigonosaurus and Barutitan. Again, these new specimens helped with the comparison, so hashtag need more fossils. They did it.
They found the new fossils.
They found the new fossils and it helped. The reason that Trigonosaurus got synonymized with Barutitan, and Barutitan is the name that we're keeping, it's pretty funny. They were actually both published in the same volume, but Barutitan was published just a few pages before Trigonosaurus. It was published on page 529, and Trigonosaurus was published on page 565.
Yep, that's how it goes.
So just beat it out by a few pages.
We've seen it where it's just like a sentence or two away, and then they go with the older name.
That's true. And then there was some confusion on the tail vertebrae, whether or not it belonged to Trigonosaurus in the Trigonosaurus specimen that had tail vertebrae, because, well, in 1999, Campos and Kellner rejected that the tail vertebrae was associated with the rest of that specimen.
I see. So it was already sort of in the works that that tail shouldn't have been the same dinosaur.
Kind
of. The rest of it.
Yeah. But then in 2005, according to the authors of this paper, it was, quote, accepted based on sparse evidence by Campos et al. So it was rejected, then kind of accepted, but they said that wasn't the strongest case that this tail vertebrae belonged with the rest of the specimen. And so based on that, it should be its own specimen and therefore its own taxon or dinosaur. And that's how we got Kyura. Again, the type species is Kyura alocaudata. There's a couple details in the 10 tail vertebrae that make it different, including part of it being robust. The genus name comes from the site where the fossils were found, and the species name means strange tail. And it lived in a semi-arid climate.
Strange tail.
Yep. Well, strange compared to those other titanosaurs.
I wonder what's going to happen with those tail vertebrae in the future, because a dinosaur that's named only from tail vertebrae could be problematic in the future, too.
Right, especially for sauropods.
Yeah, I mean, people have pointed out that the vertebrae of sauropods are some of the most diagnostic bones, some of the best for naming a dinosaur. But whenever you have just part of it, it's possible that something's already been named that, you know, had that tail and we just didn't find the tail originally.
It's possible. I mean, that's considering how this dinosaur came to be named, I'm sure there's room for changes.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I've got a story about Laelaps / Dryptosaurus. I think one of the coolest dinosaurs. This paper was written by William Gallagher and published in the Anatomical Record. And this article is open access, which is pretty cool if you want to see some pictures. Back in 1866, Cope named laylaps from some large bones in New Jersey that he considered pretty bird-like, which is cool. It's one of the earliest references to a large non-avian dinosaur resembling a bird. It's not the first reference, because I think by this point, Thomas Henry Huxley was already comparing Archaeopteryx to Coelophysis and talking about dinosaurs evolving into birds.
Yeah, I think so.
But only by a couple of years. And the connection to Archaeopteryx is much more obvious than this huge thing that was walking around on land, bigger than almost all living land animals at the time.
That's a good point.
I think laylaps is a really excellent name. It refers to a dog in Greek mythology that always caught what it was hunting.
Too bad the name didn't stick around.
Well, unfortunately for all of us, especially Cope, who named it, laylaps was already the name for a mite. And because every animal, including small insects and bugs and everything, has to have a unique genus name, the fact that laylaps was a mite means that laylaps the dinosaur at, you know, a million times the size, and no one would ever possibly confuse these two animals or probably even study them at the same time. But it still had to be renamed regardless because of the taxonomic rules.
I hope it's a mighty mite that lives up to its name.
I don't even think it's that good of a mite. Mm. But like when you search laylaps anywhere, mm-hmm. all you find is the dinosaur. Nobody ever talks about this mite. You have to search laylaps mite or laylaps original name or something like that, and then you find some reference to this mite that nobody talks about. Anyway, Marsh was more than happy to steal Cope's thunder and renamed laylaps to Dryptosaurus 11 years after Cope named laylaps.
Yeah, he was probably really happy to notice that mistake.
Yeah, they were very happy to point out each other's mistakes. But the name laylaps was already pretty popular in that 11-year time span because it was a big carnivore and we didn't have that many dinosaurs back then. Plus, Cope and Marsh were very good at emphasizing the discoveries that they had made. And so a lot of people, and it has such a cool name, mm-hmm. the origin of it. If people were familiar with Greek mythology, it's like really evocative.
Yeah. Maybe if it was able to keep its name, we'd know it as well as T-Rex.
Yeah, it's possible. And interestingly, I'll talk about this a little more later, but it is a potentially a tyrannosauroid. So it has a lot of connections to T-Rex.
Ooh.
I think its name confusion, though, is not unlike Brontosaurus in that a lot of people kept using it, even though technically laylaps is a mite and Dryptosaurus is the dinosaur. People just liked laylaps better, and it had already sort of gotten into the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So way later in 1897, when Charles Knight did a painting of Dryptosaurus, he called it Leaping Laylaps.
Really famous work of art.
It's really cool. I didn't know about it until we started this podcast, but it's a laylaps laying on its back with its legs up in the air trying to defend itself while another laylaps is jumping, claws out.
Leaping, one might say.
Yeah. Onto the lower laylaps. So it's like a laylaps jumping onto another laylaps, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. We talked to Jason Shine about the really cool new sculpture of the Leaping Laylaps that they did at the New Jersey State Museum. And we talked about that in episode 385. It's really cool. They basically recreated that whole thing I just described, but with skeletons of laylaps rather than in art. It was awesome. Jurassic Park definitely wasn't the first depiction of dinosaurs running and jumping. I know we often mistakenly say that sometimes too, but this is 1897. So it's almost 100 years mm-hmm. before Jurassic Park. There was this depiction of them being very active, maybe even more active than you see in Jurassic Park. Like I said, Dryptosaurus/laylaps, if you want to keep the name going, is probably a tyrannosauroid. We're not really sure about that because we don't have a super complete Dryptosaurus to work from, but it seems like the bones are most similar to tyrannosauroids. And it lived at the same time as T-Rex. It was in the latest Cretaceous, basically similar to the Hell Creek in that it's the very top layer of the Cretaceous rock. That's where you find laylaps. Although, hopefully for Dryptosaurus, it may have never met a T-Rex. And I say hopefully because T-Rex was about five times the weight of Dryptosaurus.
Not to mention that bite force.
Yes. And we're not super confident in the size of Dryptosaurus because we have way more T-Rex to work with. And Dryptosaurus, I think the best fossil we have is still from a juvenile.
Mm.
Dryptosaurus was probably more like the size of an Allosaurus, but the closest specimens we have of Dryptosaurus and T-Rex are about 500 to 1,000 miles apart.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't have found each other, or it was very unlikely that they would have.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there are some, if Dryptosaurus is less common, maybe there are some overlapping, and it also depends on if you consider Nanotyrannus to be Tyrannosaurus, how far apart they were, but that's a whole other story.
Dryptosaurus wouldn't have had to worry about Nanotyrannus if Nanotyrannus is valid.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm not really sure. But we don't need to get into the whole Nanotyrannus thing, though. We could go on about that for a while. So a lot of dinosaurs in New Jersey were discovered in marl pits. Marl used to be used as an additive for soil in agriculture, and that was to add calcium and also reduce the acidity of the soil. It's similar to putting crushed coral in an aquarium. If you have pet fish, you might be familiar with this process. I've done it from time to time. You can also throw in a cuttle bone, other sources of calcium. They're just good at absorbing and neutralizing acids, so it can be handy. But when the marl industry in New Jersey declined, the number of dinosaur discoveries also basically fell off a cliff because, as we know, Cope and Marsh, that was their original battle, was basically over a marl pit in New Jersey where all these dinosaurs were being discovered.
Well, yeah, that's one of the catalysts.
I feel like that's what really kicked off the fight for finding the dinosaurs. There was sort of an academic issue over criticizing each other.
Yeah.
But as far as hunting for bones aggressively, that was the first spot. Fortunately, even though there isn't so much marl digging going on in New Jersey, people still occasionally dig through the waste heaps from these marl pit quarrying activities, and they found some new bones. More specifically, pieces of bones. They found 6 pieces of quote-unquote long bones.
Oh, arm bones?
Yeah, it could be arm bones, could be leg bones. I think there are a couple other bones that count as long bones, but yeah, basically limb bones. Plus, quote, a dozen or so smaller fragments. But the long bones are the important ones, and they have an unusual texture inside. It appears mostly like it's dense layered bone, but there's a thin layer of porous bone on the inside. This type of bone in other situations has been called medullary bone, which is attributed to egg laying.
Ooh, adds a layer of intrigue here.
Yeah, I think you've talked quite a bit about medullary bone.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it has a headline like, this dinosaur was female.
Yep, or pregnant, or yeah.
Recently laid an egg or something like that. On at least one fragment, the porous bone is also a different color. It's lighter than the rest of the bone, so it really stands out as a separate sort of type of bone. But unfortunately, like I said, the bones are really fragmentary. One of the best pieces is from the middle of the femur. And when I read mid-femur, I was like, okay, we see that all the time where basically the top and the bottom of the femur are broken off. That's not what they mean by mid-femur at this point. They mean like the inside of the femur, like the entire outside is broken away and you've got this weird chunk of just the middle of the bone left.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not the best bone to work with when you're trying to figure out what kind of animal a dinosaur bone is from.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically all the features of it are on the outside, different bumps and things. If all that's broken off.
Right, then what do you have left?
Yeah.
Well, maybe something like medullary bone.
Exactly. And I guess in this case, it's nice because you don't always break open the bones to check if there's medullary bone inside.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, nature did that for us. So we can see this medullary bone or potential medullary bone.
Thanks, nature.
Yeah. Fortunately, though, there is, given the medullary bone looking stuff and just the general structure of the bone, we can tell it's probably from a theropod, which is why I was talking so much about Dryptosaurus before,
mm-hmm.
because that's the big theropod we know from the quarry. So it's a decent contender for the bone haver.
That really flows off the tongue.
Yeah. We don't know the total circumference of the femur because we only have that, you know, middle piece. You can't measure the outside of it. But they estimate that it's about 21 centimeters or 8 inches, just based on, I guess, extrapolating how much bigger it would have been. Obviously, that's a pretty rough estimate.
Mm-hmm.
If it was 21 centimeters in circumference, that would put the animal at a rough weight of about 2/3 of a ton.
Not bad.
And that's a little bit smaller than a typical Dryptosaurus, but still the most likely named dinosaur from that formation. Of course, it could always be something new, too.
Could be new, could be a juvenile. Hard to say.
Yeah.
Well, with the if it's medullary bone, maybe it's not a juvenile, but maybe a subadult.
Yes. And, you know, there's various, not all dinosaurs grow to the exact same size. It could just be a smaller individual. The author seems to favor the hypothesis that it is medullary bone, just based on the way that the paper is written. There's a lot about medullary bone, not a whole lot about pathology, even though the abstract says this could be medullary bone or pathology. Most of the paper is about medullary bone. They can't rule out osteopetrosis, which is the sort of weird bone growth pathology where stuff gets too dense or denser than is expected to become, and there's just like extra bone growing.
Oh, what if that happened and then it like broke open the rest of, and that's why we just have this weird middle piece.
Oh, that'd be very sad.
Yeah,
it makes the bones fragile and more likely to fracture when they have osteopetrosis. You can get that in living animals, including humans today. But in this case, it does look a little bit more like medullary bone, I think, because it's more of an even growth. And it looks like other medullary bone that has been reported in the fossil record, which would be a really handy thing to do with this. We could compare it chemically or take some histology of this reported medullary bone and compare it to some of those T-Rex or other dinosaurs from other formations and see if they have a lot in common. We might be able to figure out sort of some key characteristics of medullary bone, confirm it to all the medullary bone skeptics. And then we might be able to better confirm that some dinosaurs are female. It's like you were saying the other day, probably the only dinosaurs we'll be really certain about the sex of is the female dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Specifically the ones that were in the process of laying eggs or had recently laid eggs.
Yeah, that's very true. Because not all female dinosaurs, even once they're sexually mature, they don't all have medullary bone. It's a sort of a seasonal thing. So we'll probably at some point know for sure that a few dinosaurs were female.
Yep.
And that's probably about as far as it'll go for a while. But again, there are still potentially other causes of this sort of medullary bone looking stuff. So we're not sure that it's medullary bone yet. Got to do some more analysis.
We're going to take a quick sponsor break. And then after that, I'm going to tell you, Garrett, about a microraptor that ate mammals.
Ooh. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. Treat yourself or a loved one to a lifetime of language learning. There are a lot of dinosaur hotspots in the world, and high on our list of places to visit is Brazil because there are so many cool dinosaur sites in that country.
Yes, it's home to some of the earliest dinosaurs like Saturnalia, a small long-necked dinosaur that weighed just a little more than a house cat. And then there's Ostroposeidon, the largest known dinosaur from Brazil. It's about 82 feet or 25 meters long. And the carnivorous Thanos. Yes, that Thanos, named for the Marvel Comics supervillain. Plus some really amazing sites like the one recently described where people from thousands of years ago made rock carvings to go alongside dinosaur tracks.
Yeah, petroglyphs and footprints in one place.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely want to learn Portuguese before we visit Brazil. One thing we've learned from our travels is you have a lot more fun adventures when you know the local language.
Yeah, and places like petroglyphs aren't always near big cities, so it's very useful to have some local language knowledge. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in handy. It's designed and refined by language learning experts, and the lessons are immersive. There's also an audio companion, which is great when you're commuting, taking long walks, or even doing chores around the house.
Perfect for when you're waiting for the next Dino episode to drop. So, saúde, or cheers. Join now at rosettastone.com/dino for a special limited time offer just for our listeners, and you'll get over 50% off for a lifetime membership. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and you'll get access to all 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right, we've got a story about gut contents, one of my favorite types of stories. This one specifically is about Microraptor and how it ate mammals. This was published in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology by David Hone and others. And we know that dinosaurs ate mammals, but now there's just more evidence that they definitely did. This is the second case where we can see a theropod that ate a mammal, and it's specifically Microraptor jowianus. So yay, gut contents.
That is really cool.
Yeah, the authors found a small mammal foot, the right foot, inside the rib cage of the holotype.
In the rib cage, huh?
Yeah. The mammal was about 1/10 the size of the Microraptor specimen. It's unclear what type of mammal it was, but it did have slender toes. The length of its toes is similar in size to mammals such as Cynodelphes, which is an early relative of modern marsupials, including possums. So this helps show us that Microraptor ate a lot of stuff, because we also know that Microraptor ate birds, fish, and lizards. These were found in other specimens. The Microraptor holotype is incomplete, but the skeleton is articulated, and there's no evidence of any rupture in the ribs, so it seems that, yes, this mammal foot was digested.
Hmm.
And the mammal foot is also articulated. It's connected.
That's really cool. Yeah, because the question always is, how do you know that it ate it and it didn't just fossilize next to it and so close next to it that it looks like it was inside of it?
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's like it would be a magic trick to try to sneak it through the rib cage without breaking any of the bones.
Exactly. So you think, yeah, this seems pretty clear that it ate this mammal. Previous papers have talked about maybe Microraptor hunted birds in the trees, or it hunted for fish, because we found birds and fish and lizards in its guts. But the authors of this paper think that that's not the case, or at least it's not the case that they both could do well, hunt in the trees and hunt for fish, just because that takes some specific skills. There are some birds, like the bald eagle, that do hunt both birds and fish, but the author said that the bald eagle is a lot more capable of flying than Microraptor. So again, seems unlikely that Microraptor could do both. The author said that the hypothesis that Microraptor hunted birds was based on the bird found in the specimen being part of a wing and both feet, and it was articulated, but it's possible that the dinosaur ate the bird in parts and scavenged the bird instead of hunted it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty hard to tell tens of millions of years later whether something ate a thing that was recently alive or it died slowly. I don't even know if you could tell that if you found something in gut contents from like 5 days ago.
Yeah. Yeah, you might have to see exactly how they ate it.
Yeah.
So we don't know if this Microraptor specimen hunted or scavenged the mammal either. It's likely, though, that Microraptor in general hunted and scavenged and also foraged in multiple places. It appears that Microraptor was capable of gliding flight, and the author said that there's evidence it could have achieved powered flight. It probably could climb, so it could get into trees. It's hard to know what sort of habitat Microraptor lived in, because we've got the birds, fish, and lizards, and now mammals that have been found inside the specimens.
Yeah, I think I remember one of the times when a fish was found, they're like, oh, it probably lived around water.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's like, I guess it just went all over the place.
Yeah. And there are multiple Microraptor species, so that could be a reason in the somewhat different diets. Like Microraptor jowiensis was found, one with a lizard, another with a mammal. Microraptor guai was found with a fish and a bird. So yeah, maybe there's some differences there.
Oh, that's cool.
What we can say, though, is that Microraptor does seem to be a generalist when it comes to food.
Yeah, for sure.
In terms of this Microraptor specimen and the mammal, it's possible the mammal was climbing and then got seized, or it's possible the mammal was scavenged.
We could come up with all sorts of fun possibilities. It's possible that the mammal was gliding mid-flight and the Microraptor was gliding next to it and bit off its foot mid-air. It's possible.
I like that scenario.
Basically, anything that ends with a foot of a mammal ending up inside Microraptor was possible.
I mean, that's interesting. But the authors are saying, like, they pointed out the foot doesn't have as much nutrition as other parts of the animal. So it's interesting that's what ended up in the gut. And maybe that's one of the last parts of that mammal to be eaten. So maybe it was scavenged.
Yeah, that's a pretty good reason to think that. Or that it was trying to snatch at it and only got the foot.
And managed to chomp off, sever the foot. Yeah,
I guess that's not so likely. It probably
midair, like, yeah.
It's a mammal that had evolved the ability to drop feet so that it could escape.
That would be interesting. A Microraptor had relatively short, deep jaws, similar to other carnivores that eat larger prey. So Microraptor may have also eaten larger animals in addition to the smaller animals. And Microraptor was built for seizing prey and injuring it with a forceful bite, though it seems unlikely it could sever a leg.
Yeah, with a single bite.
With a single bite,
I don't even know if a T-Rex could pull that off. It still probably takes some yanking and ripping.
Yeah. Turns out over 300 articulated Microraptor specimens have been found.
Oh, man, that's so many.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was so many.
That's how you get multiple species.
Yes, and it may explain why we know about its generalist diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you find 300 and 1% of them have something in their guts, then you got three gut contents right there.
Yeah, and exactly. It means we see way more gut contents for Microraptor compared to pretty much any other dinosaur.
That's so cool.
It is.
Microraptor is a really cool one.
Yes. I didn't realize there were so many found specimens.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. You can get such a better understanding of an animal when you get hundreds of fossils than when you're just working from, say, a partial tail section of vertebrae, for example. Just pull it out a random example.
I see. Random.
like a lot of sauropods, one might say.
Speaking of sauropods, let's just go back to sauropods. Dippy has a 3-year residency at Coventry's Herbert Art Gallery and Museum.
Oh, it's still on the road.
Well, sort of. I guess not for the next 3 years at this residency.
Oh, I see. I was thinking it's not back at the British Museum because there was something about how they were going to make some permanent thing for it, maybe.
Maybe. But for now, you can see Dippy starting February 20th. You can get free tickets. And as a reminder, Dippy is a cast of 5 skeletons. There's 292 bones. It takes about a week to reassemble Dippy. I'm sure they've got it down, though, after Dippy's gone on tour.
When you say it's a cast of 5 skeletons, that means Dippy is based on 5 different Diplodocus?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So the original that's mounted in the Carnegie Museum is an amalgamation.
Exactly. Our last piece of news is about a new dinosaur movie that's coming out. The trailer came out in December, so I know people have already been talking about it, like I saw in our Discord. It's 65.
That's the name of the movie?
Yeah, that's the name of the movie. And it comes out in March 17th. Apparently, this film was announced back in 2020. It stars Adam Driver, who crashes into an unknown planet, then finds out he's actually stranded on Earth, and it's 65 million years ago. And he's got one other survivor with him, who's played by Ariana Greenblatt.
Why did they make it 65 and not at least 66? They're going with like the 1950s estimate of when dinosaurs went extinct.
Oh, maybe.
That just seems
like... Maybe they like the way 65 looks better as the film title.
I guess. It seems like such a simple thing to get wrong.
Anyway.
It doesn't bode well for the scientific accuracy of this movie, I guess is what I'm saying.
The tagline is, quote, "The search for a new world led to prehistoric Earth." And to survive, they're going to have to fight some dinosaurs.
I'm kind of surprised that Adam Driver is in this, and it's not like a really low-budget goofball movie.
Oh, I am not surprised because in the trailer looks like some pretty high-quality CGI.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The dinosaurs, they look kind of like the Jurassic Park style,
mm-hmm.
and there's some similar sounds too. The people who made it, it's from the writers of the movie A Quiet Place.
Oh, nice.
So it seems like it's kind of like a horror film.
Oh, that's cool.
Kind of like the original Jurassic Park.
I've gone from being very pessimistic to very optimistic course of this description.
That was very quick.
I get really critical about scientific inaccuracies.
I mean, I don't know about the scientific accuracy of the dinosaurs, but it does look entertaining.
If it's a horror movie, I basically let them do whatever they want to make it scarier. That makes it better.
I think it's been tagged as thriller, but in the trailer, it just seemed like horror to me. It seemed like the first Jurassic Park with the suspense and everything.
You said they sound like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. What was that? Is it just like a scene of a dinosaur roaring kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah. You just kind of, you hear them, which is what contributes to this horror effect. You
okay.
don't see them all the time.
I'm hoping it's more like the first Jurassic Park where they're not so much like screaming as they're about to attack and it's more like slinking around, because that would definitely make it more intense. The fact that it's made by the people that made A Quiet Place
mm-hmm.
seems like they're aware of the fact that quiet is scarier. Maybe they'll accurately depict how animals hunt in quiet.
Maybe. And we'll find out in March, I guess.
Might be the first dinosaur blockbuster that doesn't have dinosaurs screaming as they're about to attack.
I think there might be some of that.
It's hard to resist.
Yeah. What's cool, though, is that we're still seeing dinosaur movies.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're filling the gap left by the end of Jurassic World.
Yeah. I mean, it probably helped that the last Jurassic World movie made a ton of money and people really liked it. That's always good for more in the genre.
Yeah. Apparently they wrapped up filming and everything in 2021.
Hmm.
So they've been ready for a while.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see people's reactions.
Well, now I'm really excited about it.
Good.
The name 65, not a big fan of, but it sounds like the movie itself could be pretty enjoyable.
Yep. We'll see. We'll see. All right. We've got another dinosaur connection challenge. Today's topic is princess scenes. This comes from Heather. Thank you, Heather.
Yeah, they requested this a really long time ago. It took us a little while to get to it. We've got a little backlog going at this point.
Got a big backlog. But we're working on it. Now, first, what is a princess scene? I had to look this up. I have sewed in the past as a hobby, but I'm very much an amateur and I know only the basics. A princess seam, it's a vertical seam. You often see it in the front and or the back of a shirt or a dress, usually women's clothing. It often goes from the armhole to the hip. It can also be in skirts. And it creates this slimming, flattering look.
Yeah, I looked it up just so I would know what a princess seam was. Mm-hmm. So I knew what you were talking about. And the picture I saw that reminded me the most, or seemed the most evocative of like a princess seam to me, was like Cinderella, like the Disney princess, where she's got that blue dress on and it's like on the top, it's very structured sort of. And then on the bottom, it's all billowy. And the top has like these little lines that go from her armpits, sort of curve in and then go down to her waist.
I don't remember those lines.
It gives like a really specific sort of, almost like an hourglass sort of emphasis on the silhouette going on. But yeah.
I guess, yeah, if it's got those lines, that would be a princess seam. There's also a thing called a princess line, which is the full dress. It doesn't have a defined waist.
Mm.
So that's not the Cinderella dress, but instead those lines go all the way down.
Oh, all the way down to the hem.
Yeah, and or at least part way down. So that, yeah, you don't have the waist part, but the vertical lines kind of keep your form. That has the form-fitting aspect. Now, supposedly the name princess seam comes from the 1880s for the princess dress named for Alexandra, Princess of Wales. And again, there's no horizontal waist seam, but they use the vertical tucks or the seams to fit the waist.
Oh, cool.
Now, as a side note, Charles Frederick Worth introduced the princess line in the early 1870s. And that's like what I was saying, these straight gown shapes, the gowns cut into the long panels. Again, no defined waist. And you've got those vertical lines instead, or the long seams that shape to the body.
Yeah, I think they kind of cut a triangle out in the top and bottom, and then you can sort of like pull it in that way with like a single vertical seam rather than like cutting out from the middle. I don't know. I'm not a seamstress. That's just what I gathered.
The pictures I saw, I didn't really see triangle shapes, but I suppose you could.
After, you don't see them after they're cut. It's just like, you know, you have to remove the material somehow so that it tapers in and out.
Mm-hmm. Princess Alexandra lived from 1844 to 1925. She was also known as Alexandra of Denmark. And from 1901 to 1910, she was Queen of the UK and British Dominions and Empress of India because she was married to King Emperor Edward VII.
It's a lot of titles.
It is a lot of titles. So as for the dinosaur connection, because a different kind of podcast could go into Alexandra's life and talk about the history and everything.
Yes.
But we're here for the dinosaurs. Alexandra has a bird named in her honor. It's a parrot.
Mm-hmm.
The type species is Polytelus alexandrae. It's also known as the princess parrot, Queen Alexandra parrot, Alexandra's parakeet, Princess of Wales parakeet, rose-throated parakeet, and Spinifex parrot. It's a pretty colorful bird slash dinosaur, because birds are dinosaur.
There's your connection.
Yes. It's mostly green. It's got a pink throat. It's blue on the top of the head, and it's got a hooked short beak.
That is colorful.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Green, pink, blue?
Yeah. Like half the rainbow colors, if you count pink as a rainbow color. Pretend yeah. Pink is red. Anyway, it's got a long, narrow tail. The males have brighter colors than females. That happens a lot with birds.
Pretty much always.
Yeah. I can't think of any examples. It lives all over Australia, the Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia. It tends to be nomadic. Apparently, it breeds in groups and then disappears. Like, they breed whenever they can, when there's plenty of food around.
So they just, like, descend. People see them all over the place, and they're like, where'd they go?
Kinda. Yeah, they're kind of hard to find, I think. Although it sounds like some people might have them as pets, because I found some videos. Anyway, they eat nectar, flowers, fruits, and berries. They also work together to mob predators. Like, they attack or harass them together.
Oh, like crows?
Yeah. So they're smart. They live for about 30 years, and they weigh around 110 to 120 grams. It's about a quarter of a pound, so they're small.
It's funny, after talking about dinosaurs, talking about something that weighs grams.
Yeah. Yeah, some non-avian dinosaurs were that small.
True. Well, I don't know about 100 grams. That's really tiny.
When they're born.
That's true. In the egg.
Yeah. The princess parrot can also talk or mimic some sounds. So one of the videos I found, it sounds like it's whistling or chirping. That's the one where Gary, you're asking, what is that noise?
Yeah. So you watched a video of it chirping just for this connection to princess seems. Well,
I wanted to know what it sounded like. Yeah. What kind of sounds did it mimic?
Can you make the sounds that it made?
Oh, you know I can't whistle.
Oh, it was a whistle. Okay.
Anyway, the princess parrot is named by John Gould, a British ornithologist. He lived from 1804 to 1881. If he had lived a little bit later, I bet he would have gotten into non-avian dinosaurs. He was very much a bird guy. He published a lot of monographs on birds, and his wife illustrated a lot of them. And he worked with Charles Darwin. He did a bunch of research in Australia, and he's considered to be the father of bird study in Australia.
Hmm. The original Australian birder.
Yeah. So there we go. That's the main connection I found to princess seams is a bird.
It's a pretty good one.
Yeah. Put a bird on it.
The princess seam is named after the same woman that a dinosaur is named after.
Exactly. Now, going into clothing, I didn't find any dinosaur costumes that had the princess seam. I didn't really expect to either.
That real tapered look to it.
But I've seen princess seams on some of the dresses and skirts with dinosaur prints. Like, I saw one recently where the print is a bunch of sauropods in snow and they're wearing Santa hats. Very cute. If you like sewing, you could make your own dress or skirt or shirt with princess seams. And there's a lot of dinosaur fabrics out there now and a lot of patterns. You can even print the patterns at home.
You're almost turning it around. If you want a connection between a dinosaur and a princess seam,
connect it yourself.
Go sew it. Go connect it with thread.
Gary, you came up with the question when we were first talking about this, like how much fabric would it take to make something for a dinosaur?
Make something with princess seams?
Yes.
In other words, clothe a dinosaur.
Clothe a dinosaur, which is a challenge in itself.
Yeah.
I'd say it very much depends on the size and shape of the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
For this challenge, I figured I'd stick with the smaller, more bird-like ones because I had parrots on the brain and also Microraptor. So Microraptor, as an example, was estimated to be up to 2.5 feet or 0.7 meters long and weigh up to 2.2 pounds or 1 kilogram. So bigger than the princess parrot.
But yeah. Just barely measured in kilograms rather than grams.
Yeah.
Like you said, up to 1 kilogram, which means the lower estimate would be in just regular old grams.
Yeah. So it's about crow-sized, at least in weight. I think you would need to do a lot of princess themes to account for its four wings.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to do a simplified line on something with all that fluff.
Actually, just seams in general, not necessarily just princess seams.
Unless you made just like a vest sort of situation, like just covering neck to like hips or a little bit back and just have holes cut for the wings and the legs. Then you could do a princess seam sort of taper from like
true.
The neck down to the
I was thinking like a blouse style, but a vest makes way more sense. Then you need less fabric. And I thought, I was saying you could get away with only 1 yard of fabric. You could probably get away with a lot less than that, but
it is sold by the yard usually, right? So
yeah. And also I was thinking you would need to cut it into multiple pieces and you have a lot of seams and there's no patterns for a micro router body shape. So you'd probably have some trial and error and you'd want the extra fabric.
That's true. How much you'd need for the final result is very different than how much you'd need for all the failed attempts.
Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking, speaking of yards, because to do a proper princess seam, you need it to be basically a continuous piece of fabric that you're just doing that one simple line down.
Mm.
You couldn't do it using modern fabric, like 1 yard fabric on anything bigger than, say, like a raptor. Because if you're getting to a sauropod or something, you'd need so many of those yards sewn together.
That's
true.
You
wouldn't be able to do a princess seam. You'd have to have fabric that was like, I don't know, 50 feet or something.
Well, you could have regular seams and then add in princess seams.
I guess, but it sort of ruins the effect of a princess seam, I think, if you have all these extra seams cutting across it.
No, if you think about a dress, maybe you've got the seams on the side, but then you have the princess seams on the front and the back.
But just for the front, like on a sauropod?
Yeah.
The front alone is like 5-6 feet across.
I did not want to get into that. That's why I chose Microraptor. I went the easy way up the challenge.
Yeah. I was thinking, after I asked you about how much fabric it would take to cover a dinosaur, I was thinking like the easiest way to do it, if you had to do it in a pinch, would probably be to go to like a outdoor store, buy a tent, and just like cut some holes in the tent and like put it on.
But then how do you make the princess seams?
Yeah, there would be no princess seams in that case.
Well, then that defeats the purpose.
That's true. Some dinosaurs wouldn't even fit in a tent, even with holes cut in it.
It's true.
In the biggest tents.
Maybe for a sauropod, you just make something to cover its tail only.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because it would just be a fashion thing. They don't need it for warmth.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're taking a sauropod and trying to get it to survive in like Canada, then you might need to put a sweater on it or something.
Well, then I think you take a different approach.
Put it in like a heated barn. It'd be easier.
Oh, I was thinking a different kind of, like, well, you see the yarn bombings?
Yeah, yarn bombing was what I was thinking too. But after you described it, it's like you don't have those types of seams on anything that's yarn.
No, yeah, that's what I mean, a different approach to the type of clothing you would clothe it with.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was wondering too, like how many skeins of yarn you need to cover a sauropod.
A lot.
Yeah.
Stick with the Microraptor.
One skein. It's plain. All right, now we're going to pause for one last sponsor break. But when we get back, Sabrina's going to talk about our dinosaur of the day, Isanosaurus. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Conglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is, if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners, and you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
And now onto our dinosaur of the day, Isanosaurus, which was a request from Tyrant King via our Patreon and Discord, so thanks. It was a sauropodomorph that lived in the late Triassic or late Jurassic. There's been some debates and updates on that, in what is now Thailand, in the Namfong Formation.
There's a very wide time range, late Triassic to late Jurassic.
Yes. So it's estimated to be about 21 feet or 6.5 meters long, based on the thigh bone. But parts of the holotype skeleton weren't fused, so the holotype may not have been fully grown, and it could have gotten bigger. It had high neural spines. The type and only species is Isanosaurus adavipacai. It was named in 2000 by Eric Buffetat and others. The genus name means northeastern Thailand lizard, Isan lizard, and Isan is the local name for northeastern Thailand. The species name is in honor of P. Adavipach, former director general of the Thai Department of Mineral Resources and a supporter of paleontological research.
Nice.
Yeah. These fossils were found in 1998. By a hunter looking for nocturnal flying squirrels who spotted the fossils in the moonlight.
I want to go look for nocturnal flying squirrels. That sounds really fun.
And then stumble upon fossils in the moonlight.
It sounds like quite a magical night.
It does.
Although, I don't know, if you're in like the rainforest in Thailand at night, it might be a little bit terrifying too.
Maybe. Just keep thinking of the squirrels.
You got to know what you're doing.
Yeah. The fossils were found in dark red sandstone. Most of the bones had eroded by the time they were found. The holotype includes a neck vertebra, back vertebra, parts of the tail, some fragmentary ribs, part of the shoulder and thigh. Now, at the time, Isanosaurus was the earliest known sauropod dinosaur. Originally, it was thought to have lived about 210 million years ago. But in 2009, Racy and Goodall dated Isanosaurus from the early Jurassic instead of the Triassic. It's one of the earliest sauropodomorphs to walk on all fours. It was an obligate quadrupedal dinosaur. It had a robust femur, quote, with a sauropod-like straight craniocaudally flattened shaft, end quote. So it had a robust straight thigh bone.
That definitely would be pretty amazing if it was 210 million years old, because that sounds a lot like a typical later Jurassic sauropod.
Yes. Yeah. Because it had these column-like legs and it walked on all fours. In bipedal sauropodomorphs, the leg bone is curved. So Isanosaurus had sauropod features, but it also had earlier features that, quote, seemed to illustrate an early stage in the evolution of characters more fully developed in later, more advanced sauropods, end quote.
Hmm. So it's not all looking like a fresh faced late Jurassic sauropod.
No, it did look like a typical sauropod with the bulky body and the long neck and the long tail and then walking on four legs. But again, it just lived pretty early.
It just had a couple features that were more like the early sauropods.
Yes.
And for our fun fact, like I said, Sabrina accidentally challenged me in our recent Patreon bonus content to figure out which states don't have state fossils.
Oops. Sent you down in a Richard Ramaeus burrow.
So I kind of talked about this a while ago. Back in episode 115, which was 5 years ago, there were 11 states plus Washington, D.C. that had either a state dinosaur and or a dinosaur as a state fossil, which isn't that many. That's only 12 areas.
Yeah.
Seven more states since then have added state dinosaurs in those last 5 years.
Hmm.
Although two of them, Connecticut and Massachusetts, both had dinosaur Trax ubrantes as their state fossil. So it was like sort of a I think at the time I included it in the state dinosaurs, but now they have like real dinosaurs, real limbs, real bones, not just Trax. Of course, if you want to be pedantic, every state technically has a state dinosaur since
birds.
Every state has a state bird. Yes. So for non-avian dinosaurs that have been selected so far in alphabetical order by dinosaur, not by state, because dinosaurs are more important, we've got Acrocanthosaurus. That's from Oklahoma. That's Oklahoma state dinosaur. Their state fossil is Saurophaganax, so they actually have like a double dinosaur situation going.
Mm-hmm.
Arkansaurus. It's the state dinosaur of Arkansas. Not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Astrodon is from Maryland. Augustinolophus from California.
Knew that one.
Pretty cool hadrosaur at the LA Natural History Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalsaurus is from Washington, D.C. That's a weird one. It's an indeterminate theropod from a single partial vertebra, which was found in 1898 during sewer construction.
All right. But they've got it.
It was found in Washington, D.C. itself, which is still pretty cool.
And that would be hard to do. D.C.'s not that big.
It's a small place to look for dinosaurs, but it's close to a lot of other dinosaur spots.
Yeah. But if you wanted to say this one came from D.C.
Yeah. Not even Washington, D.C.'s sports teams, I don't think, play in Washington, D.C. So, but they have a dinosaur that's actually in Washington, D.C. Then you got Coelophysis. That one's from New Mexico. That's an excellent choice. Coelophysis is so cool. There's like 100 of them from New Mexico. Dilophosaurus from Connecticut. Obviously, after the Ubrantes Trax, they finally added in the dinosaur that might have made the Trax.
Mm-hmm.
Dryptosaurus from Delaware should be from New Jersey because, as we know, it's from New Jersey. But I guess they can have it if they want it.
They found some in Delaware, too.
That's because New Jersey has Hadrosaurus, also from New Jersey, and the first ever mounted dinosaur.
Hattie, yeah.
Although that's now in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Poor New Jersey.
Well, at least these states are all close to each other.
Yeah, that's true. There's Myasaura from Montana, the good mother dinosaur with the Egg Mountain being in Montana. I think that's a pretty good selection. Parasaurus from Missouri.
Mm.
Another hadrosaur. The Podokasaurus from Massachusetts. You talked a lot about that when that one was getting passed.
Mm-hmm.
Paluxysaurus / Sauroposeidon from Texas. Sonorosaurus from Arizona. Stegosaurus from Colorado. Triceratops is both the state dinosaur from Wyoming and the state fossil from South Dakota. And Utah Raptor, which is the new state dinosaur of Utah as of 2018. And they also have Allosaurus as their state fossil, which they've had since 1988.
Nice.
So when you add it up, you've got 8 theropods: Acrocanthosaurus, Saurophaganax, Capitalosaurus, Coelophysis, Dilophosaurus, Dryptosaurus, Podokasaurus, and Utah Raptor. 7 Ornithischians: Arkansaurus, Augustinolophus, Hadrosaurus, Myasaura, Parasaurus, Stegosaurus, and Triceratops. And 3 sauropods: Astrodon, Sauroposeidon, Sonorosaurus. None of the 7 Ornithischian dinosaurs, though, are ankylosaurs, which is a huge bummer.
Of course you would notice that.
I would. And T-Rex is still up for grabs. Of all 5 of the dinosaurs that were added, no one picked T-Rex. Is the thing that continues to astound me.
That's surprising.
Every single news item that they can, they shove T-Rex into the title to make it get more clicks, but nobody wants it as a state fossil. It's so weird.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the friendliest. Maybe that's the problem. Also, it's been found in several states, so it's not really unique to any state, but it's still just like...
So has Dryptosaurus.
And Triceratops, which 2 of them have.
Yeah.
It's just so weird. As Sabrina mentioned in the bonus content, there are 6 states that don't have state fossils at all, let alone, you know, state dinosaurs is more specific. We're actually down to 5 now, since a few months ago, Indiana adopted the mastodon as their state fossil, copying Michigan. Minnesota could get the giant beaver soon.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that in the bonus content. The other 4 that don't have any state fossil are Iowa, which might eventually get the crinoid, aka the sea lily.
Mm.
It was attempted in 2018, but failed.
Well, it's been a few years.
It has, yeah. I mean, things have happened.
Yeah.
In New Hampshire, they also tried to make mastodon their state fossil in 2015. But since Michigan and now Indiana already have it anyway, it's like, come up with something new, New Hampshire. Why do you need that? Hawaii and Rhode Island don't have safe houses either, and I couldn't even find anything of anybody trying. So if you're one of those places and you want a state fossil, it's up for grabs.
T-Rex. T-Rex for Hawaii and Rhode Island.
Yeah. One last weird thing I noticed. Texas and Arkansas are the only states that have state dinosaurs, but no official state fossil. But since dinosaurs are fossils, it basically counts.
Just not officially.
Yeah.
And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thank you so much for listening, and celebrate our 8th anniversary with us. That Triceratops leveled above comes with a sweet limited edition patch.
If you join by January 2023.
Yep. Patreon.com/I Know Dino. Thanks again, and until next time.